We have three items on my agenda today. The first of which is acceptance of the annual auditor's report and financial statements for the year ended June 30th. I believe we have Brad on the line that will have a presentation on this.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Good morning to the Board of Regents. My name is Brad Shelley, and I am a managing director at Crowe, and happy to be with you virtually this morning to present the results of the audit. I also have with me Max Walton, who is the manager on the engagement and was heavily involved throughout the process.
Excuse me, Brad. I was just going to, before we get to your slides, I was just going to cover a few highlights. So next slide, and then I'll turn it over to you guys. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just, the slides are going to get out of sync, I know. So next slide, please. So again, just before, I turn it over to our auditors, I just wanted to hit some real quick highlights. Another good audit for us was a clean audit, unqualified opinion. That's the best you can get. No audit findings is another great result. As far as financially, I think we did well in fiscal year 20. Our cash equivalent increased by $11 million, despite the things that we dealt with the start of the pandemic. Net position increased by $58 million. Now, in full transparency, a lot of that has to do with the pension adjustment that is calculated by the state. But our net position did, in fact, before that adjustment, it did increase. By around $4 million. So with that, Brad, again, sorry for interrupting, but I just wanted to make those introductory comments. I'll turn it over to Brad and Max to go through the audit findings.
No problem. Thanks, Susan. So if you go ahead to the next slide here. So I wanted to just give the board, again, a little bit of background on the audit process. I know we go through this annually, but I think it's always important to kind of refresh. And so really the purpose of the audit has a lot of different layers, as you see there in the graphic, whether it's following rules or compliance with regulations, providing transparency on your financial transactions and balances. All of those are critical and part of the reason why you have the audit performed on an annual basis. As part of that audit, we look at internal controls, we look at your financial reporting, we look at identifying risks and setting materiality, and we also look at the compliance with your federal grant programs, which of course you have many. So all of that is rolled up into the audit process, and that's what we're presenting on today. The financial statements themselves include some various audit highlights, but then also include management's discussion analysis, which gives you a little bit more depth to the conversation, I guess, gives a little bit of background on why the balance has changed and allows you to see the comparative information there. That all rolls up, and we also provide the management recommendations. So as we'll go through later, any material weaknesses or significant deficiencies in internal control, we are required to report in writing. The teaser on that is we did not have any to report this year, so that is good, obviously, and a clean audit from that perspective. Next slide, please. So the background on what does that really include? Because there's a lot of different work that we're doing as part of this, and so to just say, you know, we're doing the audit doesn't really give you a full picture of what all is included. So obviously, but then there's the audit report on the university's financial statements, and everyone's aware of that and used to seeing those. Also includes the single audit for the uniform guidance report. So this is the reports related specific to the federal grants that you receive, and that is also an annual requirement. We also include the SAS 114 letter, which is a required audit communication letter. That just goes through a variety of information on any disagreements or audit adjustments or things of that nature. We'll also include the House Bill 622 letter and the Kentucky Lease Law Compliance Report. Both of those are required one-page letters from the required by the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And then additional work that we do that isn't completed yet, and this is always completed later, is separate audit reports for the WKYU TV and FM radio financial statements. That work is going to be completed in November, with reporting done likely in December. And similarly, the NCAA read about procedure work that is also done in November and completed in December. So we'll report on those at a later meeting. Next slide, please. From a financial statement standpoint, the financial statements that we present include City University, but it also includes WKU Research Foundation, which has no activity in the current year, but it still does exist, and so it's a blended component unit within there. In the past, we did perform the audit related to that, since there's no transactions related to it. There's obviously no audit to it, but it is still included theoretically. It also includes three discretely presented component units. The discretely presented component units is a fancy way of saying those are included, and you can see those specifically in your financial statements. So those are literally basically copied and pasted in there. Those are audited by other auditors that we work with to gain an understanding on procedures they performed, and we rely on those audits. Those are WKU Foundation, the WKU Student Life Foundation, and College Heights Foundation. Next slide, please. So looking at some of the financial information, I wanted to just summarize this a little bit. So in your statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in that essentially statement, this gives you just kind of a three-year snapshot of the high level, your operating revenues, expenses, and then your non-operating revenues, expenses, and capital contributions. And so as you look here, you know, you can see kind of in the upper third that your operating loss is a loss every year. And this is just the way that government accounting standards are required to present the financial information. And as a public university, you're considered your accounting is under government accounting standards. So any kind of funding that is not your tuition or operating types of revenues, that is not included in there. Your state appropriations, your federal grants, assistance, state grants, those are all included in the net non-operating revenues expenses. So don't be alarmed by the operating loss of $79.9 million. There's always going to be an operating loss. That's offset by those non-operating revenues expenses. So as you get down to the bottom, the change in that position, as Susan mentioned, for this year was $58 million to the positive. But again, to be fully transparent, a large chunk of that is related to pension and OPEB and how that had a positive impact on your bottom line. So as you may recall from past presentations, there are some actuarial evaluation calculations that are done to determine what your net pension liability and net OPEB liability are for your involvement in the KERS and KTRS plans. And so that can go up or down each year based on changes in assumptions, based on changes made in the plan, based on contributions made by the Commonwealth of Kentucky. All those have an impact on that net bottom line for you. And for this year, it was a positive benefit for you, so it actually lessened your expense by $55 million. So again, I think it's just important to understand that that is a big chunk of that. As you can see in each of the 3 years, that for the most part is out of the university's control. So in these years where it changes for the positive, that's a good thing, obviously, for the university. But as things change throughout years, that could end up being a negative at some point. It's just good to be aware of that. So as you look at you pull that piece out, you do end up with about $3.3 million positive change in net position, which again, I think is a very good thing, considering, you know, the pandemic that you had to operate in for the last essentially 3 months, 3.5 months of the fiscal year. Next slide, please. This is a snapshot of just the statement of net position or your balance sheet. Again, the thing that you see here is you do see a trend, I would say, of decreasing assets and deferred outflows, which, again, some of that is pension and OPEB related, especially in the deferred outflows. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Your total assets for this year actually increased about $4 million, but the deferred outflows of these sources actually decreased by about $18 million. So that's why you see the decrease there. Correspondingly, in the liabilities and deferred inflows, you see significant decreases, which is, I would say, a positive thing. So that has continued to go down, and again, a big chunk of that is related to your net pension and net OPEB liabilities. And then the last set of bar graphs here on the far right is your net position, or essentially your equity. And if you recall several years ago when the government accounting standards changed and required you to record those net pension and net OPEB liabilities, that pushed you into a negative position overall. Knowing full well that you don't have to pay those out, anytime soon as a very long-term liability. But it did push most government agencies into a negative position. What you've seen here is a trend of positive movement, and at the end of the year, you're almost to a break-even standpoint from a net position standpoint, with a negative $4.3 million. Next slide, please. So that covers most of the financial results. From a single audit or federal compliance standpoint, as I mentioned earlier, we do testing of those federal grants. There's two reports that we issue related to that. The first one is they're in compliance with the government auditing standards. The second one is compliance for each major federal program and internal control over compliance. So that second one is specific to the grants that we test. And there's a process to determine which grants that we test each year. Some of those are rotated by requirements. So the four major programs that we tested this year were Student Financial Aid, TRIO Cluster, Manufacturing Extension Partnership, and the CARES Act funding that was received through FERC this year. So obviously an additional amount this year. Typically we test two to maybe three major programs. This year, due to the unique nature of the pandemic and getting the CARES Act funding, that required an additional major program, so we tested that as well. The key thing here is the big check mark. So no material weaknesses, no significant deficiencies, no reportable findings based on our testing. And so very clean report from that standpoint. Next slide, please. So the last couple of slides here are really just some additional communications. I mentioned the OB community and SAS 114 requirements. Again, no significant changes in anything. There were no significant accounting policies or estimates that were changed during the year, and no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies that we were put on. So clean from that standpoint. One more slide. There were also no posted audit adjustments. There were also no waived audit adjustments. So those are the adjustments that we identified that were maybe not material, but above our minimum threshold. And there were none of those either. So very good job by the accounting and finance team in preparing the financial statements and also throughout the year accounting for the transactions properly. Definitely to be commended there. This last couple bullets here under the audit or other communications, there were no significant difficulties encountered. There were no disagreements, no consultations, nothing along those lines. So nothing to report from that standpoint. And again, just a clean audit report. If you go one more slide, I think that is everything related to this year's financial statements. These three items I listed here, just to make the board aware, there are some new accounting statements that will be coming up soon. They'll be effective either next year or the following year. The SB84 related to fiduciary activities is one that was actually supposed to be effective for this year. The pandemic, the GASB decided to delay all of these implementations and push them all back one year. So that'll be implemented next year. GASB 87 on leases is probably the most complex. That'll be the most time-consuming for the university, just gathering all the information on the various leases and contracts and agreements that are out there for the accounting department to really dig into and determine, you know, what kind of impact and if anything needs to be recorded there. And then GASB 89 is an additional one that discusses the accounting for interest costs before the construction period. But that's, again, implemented in 2 years from now. Next slide. So that's everything that I have. I'll open up to any questions anyone has for me. But again, thank you for taking a few minutes today to allow me to present the audit results.
Thank you, Brad. That's a fantastic audit result. Congratulations to Susan and her team. Does anybody have any comments or questions?
Hi, Brad.
Dave.
Brad, this is David Brinkley. In another role as the head of public broadcasting, I can't ask this question when we're presenting our audit later this year, but, you know, when and correct me if I'm wrong, but when GASB, I think it was GASB 68, when that hit, it sent kind of all of us that have these types of audits into a tailspin in the way that we traditionally have relied upon net position as a measurement of financial strength. And I was wondering from your opinion if, and there's 2 points to this. Number one, I also want to, I want you to re-stress that the retirement liability is not a number that the university creates. It's a number that's created for the university and we have no control over and can wildly fluctuate to really kind of upset the stability of what had traditionally been a way to look at a net position year to year in comparison. My question is there another measure? Because it's really difficult for the university to say it's been a good year, because what we have to say constantly is, yes, but there's this retirement liability piece. Yes, but these GASB standards have created an issue for the way that we report. Is there a better number to measure strength where we don't have to have a disclaimer?
Well, not one that stands out, you know, directly from the financial statements like maybe net position would have previously. So a couple of things that I typically point people to is, again, that change in net position, but then factoring in the pension and OPEB expense. And so on your financial statements in particular, that pension and OPEB expense is listed on a separate line. So if you were to look at the actual statement of revenues and expenses and changes in net position, you would see on the expenses a positive number, or it's actually showing up as a negative, but it's a positive impact for pension and OPEB expense of $55 million. And so you really have to do a little bit more digging and look at that to see kind of what I was mentioning earlier. You know, we had $58.3 million increase in that position, but 55 of that was out of our control. Now, that still leads you to a good year. $3 million positive change in that position is still a good year. And I think when you look at that, especially on a trend basis, that's what I presented in 3 years. If you're able to look at each year and see kind of that positive trend, that allows you to look, kind of smooth that over, I guess, in case you have a year that's maybe down a little bit or you have some timing issues. As it relates to the net position, you know, again, I think if you're looking at the statement of net position or your balance sheet, it takes a little bit more work, right? So you need to pull out those net pension and OPEB liabilities, which for this year is about $290 million. So again, when you talk about the impact on this, it's pretty significant for most organizations, most universities, and other government agencies out there. it's a pretty significant liability that's out there. And you're right. Really the only role that you have in this or say in this is just participating in those plans, like participating in KTRS and KERS plans. And but within those plans, BBKU has no say over, the discount rate that's used or contribution requirements or anything along those lines. That's all dictated by the plans themselves. So those fluctuate up or down depending. Fortunately for most government agencies in Commonwealth of Kentucky is we've seen those plans trying to get those plans more funded. And so as those continue to get better funded, that liability goes down, and that has a positive impact on the financial statements for all the different government agencies. But you were right on that. That's something that's really out of the university's control.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Slide 9 does detail the change.
Okay.
Yeah. I have a question along very similar lines. So this is the third time I'm seeing this, and it repeatedly leaves me deeply uneasy. Why? Because, if I look at this and I look at this net pension liability, it has changed in that 3 years you reported by $140 million. And if you throw in this OPEB, it's another $15 million. And then I see a change in that position, which is around $105 million, right? So it's $155 we're gaining by a decrease in this liability, but our net position only changes by $105. And so I'm not an expert on reading these things, but it always leaves me queasy because I don't really know if we are actually doing good or not, because these huge fluctuations wipe out everything. And so I think it would be very, very helpful, at least to people like me on this board, if there would be I know we're required to do this by law, but if there would be a way to report this where these things can be simply wiped out and so be comparing apples with apples, I think that would be much more helpful than the report as it is presented here.
Yeah, I totally understand. It's not the easiest to read, especially when you're in multiple plans. And really, the thing I would say there, though, is those deferred inflows and deferred outflows also factor into that. So it's not just the net pension and net OPEB liabilities that factor in. If those deferred inflows or deferred outflows fluctuate a lot, which they have, that also has an impact. And so, really going back to slide 6, I think it was, that is what I tried to show there, is pulling that out. I mean, yes, you're required to include it in there. There's no way to pull it out. There's no way to say, we're not going to record this liability. You would not have an unqualified audit opinion if that was the case. So the best that can be done is what we've done, I think, on the financial statements, which is pull that piece of pension and OPEB expense, or in this case, income, we'll call it income or contra expense, out and show it separately on there. And then on the slide here, I try to do the same thing to show, if you pull that out, you're looking at $3.3 million positive this year, about a $10.9 million positive in FY19, and about a $5.4 million positive in FY18. So when you look at those trends, each year you're in the positives, and, did this year's go down? Yes, but I think that can, be explained fairly easily with the way things went towards the end of the year. And obviously there's other impacts as well, but I think that's really, probably the best way to look at it is to do what you're saying and kind of pull that piece out. But from an audited financial statement standpoint, there's not much we can really do to show it differently. We're required to follow the government accounting standards.
I understand that that's what you were trying to do, so I appreciate it.
Yep.
Supervisor, I mean, every other college or university can be taken from the same thing.
Yes.
Yes.
Any person that would want to evaluate us against anyone else, you'd be looking at apples and apples and making a comparison in terms of how we're managing Did you guys know that?
Yes, yeah, and I haven't, no, I don't know what the other university's net position looks like, but they're all dealing with the same thing, and yeah. All government agencies within Commonwealth, Kentucky, but all government agencies and colleges and universities across the country have the same thing. So, yeah, they're all dealing with the same thing, and I have many clients who have a negative net position, and it's, you know, at first when this was implemented 5-6 years ago now, there was a lot of concern over it because it pushed a lot of people into the negatives. And I think to some extent it kind of did maybe what the GASB was intending to do, which was make people aware of, hey, there is this liability out here. You do have a liability. It's not due in the next year or 5 years or even 10 years, but by participating in this plan, you have agreed to provide these benefits. And there is a liability that's going to be paid out over a very extended amount of time. The difficulty in that is because it's so extended and so because it's so long-term, there's a lot of assumptions that are built in there, and there's a lot of different rates that can impact that. And within the, without getting too much into the weeds, if you look in the footnotes of financial statements, you can see there's actually a required table in there for both pension and OPEB that shows what a 1% change in the discount rate does to the liability, and it's significant. Like, it could be looking this year just the CERS plan, and it's a $19 million swing, you know, depending on that 1% discount rate. And that's, again, nothing that's in your control.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Sure.
Thank you. Yep. I think the only thing I'm trying to really highlight here, Brad, is that it becomes more difficult for the university to accurately, in a snapshot, tell a story of its developing financial picture because of this fluctuation. And while the board will understand it and have the 300 pages to read and digest before we come in here, I think it makes the narrative more difficult for all the universities. And again, this is not a WKU problem. It's because of that continued fluctuation and that wild variance where people will traditionally compare what they will think apples and apples will be, which will be the net position of us versus Chicago College of Business or something in another state. And that is also a challenge that I think we face that creates a difficult narrative position for the administration to be in. I'm not defending that, I'm just saying I think it adds an extra layer of difficulty that I wish there was a better snapshot way around than having to say, yeah, we're doing better, but there's this pension liability that we're not really responsible for. And that's the added point. So I appreciate the discussion and the time. Excellent points. Thank you for your time on this.
Just one other comment related, because I think it is a very good point in terms of trying to explain it. Anybody that's working at a factory, working for a company, working for a nonprofit organization, has the same issue. You know, we're trying to figure out, yeah, a liability, we provide retirement benefits. And so it is difficult to explain, but it's not uncommon even when you move out here. Maybe the way we calculate it for a public university may be different how we do it somewhere else. But the liability itself is mentioned. Everybody is having to deal with it. And I think I'm not an accountant, so I know what it implies, but when I think about what the county board is thinking through is trying to make sure that people who recognize it, that here's what I look like today, but as an organization and as people that I'm saying I provide some financial benefit to you in the future, that people recognize that is a real liability. It's not just something that we're doing from accounting, it's real. And so I think that from a larger perspective in terms of how you look at any organization's financial, it's really trying to make sure that you recognize, even for the average person, even for the average employee, to understand that that actually does exist, and it's part of the overall financial picture of the organization.
Yeah, agreed.
Any other comments or questions?
I just like Bridget McKinney to remind folks that we went through a transition in leadership starting on July 1 of the past year, including turnover among folks who are leading accounting and financial work within that division. And I just want to thank Susan Haworth and her entire staff for producing a clean audit report with no issues in a time when they were also learning how to do their jobs from scratch. I think it's a terrific accomplishment. And I know the effort that went into that, so I just want to say thank you for the work you've done.
Yes, I would just second that. I really appreciate the entire team's assistance throughout the audit process. You know, this year was obviously a different process for us as well. We did a lot more of the work remotely, just trying to stay off of campus as much as possible while still performing the audit requirements and audit testing we needed to. And the team was very helpful throughout, including the student financial aid team, providing all the information and limiting our amount of time on campus looking at them.
Okay. Hearing no further discussion, I'll entertain a motion to approve FB1.
So moved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, George. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? FB1 passes unanimously. We have two more items on our agenda, and then we'll take a short break before the information items. FB2 is the next acceptance of the 2021 Statement of Revenue and Expenditures. Susan, do you have a presentation on that?
Yeah, I'm waiting here for the slides to come up, so there we go. So, next slide. First, let me say, I think the university has done an incredible job towards making progress towards our, for those of you who remember, our $27 million savings goal that we have in this budget. So, I think these highlights will show the board the great progress that we're doing under the leadership of our president and provost. So, tuition and fees, this is really great news. We're at 53% of our annual budget and tracking higher than prior year first quarter. So what's really important about this is to note that our fall semester tuition, actual tuition, is $5.1 million over the fall semester budget. So that's excellent news. And just remember that what led to that positive result were the 400 additional freshman students that we were able to land. That offset some of the decline that we were seeing in the smaller classes moving through the pipeline. So our state appropriation for the first quarter is 33% of the annual budget. That's slightly higher than prior year, and that is directly related to the fact that we built in a 10% reduction in appropriation that we will most likely realize mid-year. So this is probably a timing that we're slightly over last year, and we'll catch up. Grants and contracts are up from prior year, primarily due to the CARES funding associated with the pandemic. So next slide, just to hit the highlight on the expenditures. We're about 29.5% of the total budget on expenditures. And I've highlighted slightly. That's slightly higher than prior year, but most of that is directly related to the increase in financial aid spend with our new scholarship program. This is more of a timing issue that will be that will catch up during the year. The great news is if you just look at actual spending over prior year, we're actually down about $5.6 million. Okay, next slide. So this is related and perhaps unrelated to the first quarter statement, but I just wanted to show you some graphics of how we're looking as far as our operational spend. That would be procurement and any type of purchase orders. So our current spend is $16.8 million as compared to last year of $21.2 million. If you look over on payroll, last year we were at $33.3 million. This year we're at $29.9 million. So I think in summary, what I can say is we're tracking nicely towards meeting that $27 million goal. So I like to remain cautiously optimistic because we have to see what happens with our spring enrollments and what happens with our state appropriation. But at this point, there's no indicators that our spring enrollment would be down. So that's all I have, Bridget McKinney, on the first statement.
Thank you very much. We have a confirmed amount from the state of what the budget reduction is. Still not confirmed. Okay.
No, it's not. It's not typically. What will happen is that the consensus forecasting group will come back into session in November to evaluate the revenue for the state. It's at that point, if the revenue is coming in, I believe it's 5% below what the budget was built on, the governor is mandated by law to take action at that point. So typically, we will learn how much of a mid-year budget reduction we will or will not get. Usually, the timing is always incredible. It's usually just as you leave for holiday break. And then they will want you to respond as soon as you get back to campus. So that's kind of the time frame, Regent McKinney, we're looking at.
Thank you.
Again, for the benefit of the new regents, we should be jumping up and down in excitement over these numbers, and they didn't just happen. They're the direct result of the initiatives over the last several years to improve not only enrollment but retention, and to raise enrollment in the freshman class by that number in the middle of a pandemic is phenomenal. And so congratulations to not just President Caboni, but everybody who put these plans in place. And we have every reason to believe that those strategies will continue to work going forward and really place Western in a uniquely good position compared to many other universities. We also need to remember the demographics. You know, college students weren't born coming up, and I think they drop off in 2 or 3 years. So that makes these initiatives and improvements that much more important. And really, I'm inspired by the fact that we've done this well.
Two quick things. The state, Susan, I just want to reconfirm the state numbers fluctuate that wildly because it's a quarterly payment, not like a monthly payment, correct?
Yes.
Okay. The second thing is, along with what Philip said, just remind the board that this is also due in a decent part, if not a large part, by the ongoing sacrifice of the staff and faculty that have agreed to salary reductions that have been imposed by this board and continue to make those sacrifices for the benefit of the greater good of the university in this challenging time period. And the stress that I would hope that those are reversed when the financial position finds itself in improving levels.
Good point.
One of the things you mentioned, we don't know what the spring tuition will be, and for that, retention is the key. And so one of the questions I had, in the fifth week, we do an assessment, and basically every student, every faculty member has to report which are the students which are doing well and which are, I mean, passing and failing. And so I'm really wondering, since we're teaching so many classes in a remote setting, do we know if there's any statistical difference between the failure rates that were reported this fall compared to, for example, prior fall?
I can actually answer that question. I'm pulling up a request that I had Ethan Logan, our new Vice President for Enrollment and Student Experience, partly from my spectacles. So you will know that we have certainly more students in fall 2020 than fall 19. And there was a minuscule tick up in total students reported for the fifth year number from 99.76 to 99.93.
So what that suggests is that we are not having an overwhelming additional reporting of students year over year. There is a bit of a tick up in failing grades. There's a tick down in excessive absences, partially, I'm sure, due to the fact that people can participate via Zoom. Where I'm most pleased is that the number of students who have one mark, that means a faculty member is concerned enough to give that student a mark, the numbers are down from 1267 to 1067. A slight tick up from 776 to 855 for 2 to 4 marks, but remember we also have increased enrollment, so those are all positive. And then the total with one or more marks has gone down from 2176 to 2090. So I know that there was a rumor about spring enrollment, and all the indicators that we have is that we are on track to do even better with persistence from fall to spring this year. Now, it's the pandemic year, who knows what occurs, but we have a lot of folks working really hard to make sure that we get folks from fall to spring, and those numbers bear that out.
Yeah, that's very encouraging.
Thank you. Our budget has taken a big hit over the last few years with international student decline for various reasons, most recently the pandemic, but are we getting near the end of that pipeline being diminished?
Richard Bale, I appreciate the question. We have endured the pain gradually, unlike many of our sister institutions who this year, because international students could not get over the transom, took a significant hit. As those, particularly from the contractual agreements we had with Saudi Arabia, as those students work their way out of the pipeline, we have about another 2 years to go, but the decline will be smoother and much more gradual. And we'll hit a baseline at which point we have to have sustainable growth or stability at least in those populations. But we've managed to offset a decline in international student revenue by focusing on our core mission of students within 100 miles.
Questions? Anybody else? Okay, hearing no further discussion, I'll entertain a motion to accept FB2.
So moved.
Thank you, David. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, George. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Good.
All opposed? The motion carries unanimously. We have, next on our agenda is FB3, approval of the personnel action. That is several pages in your packet. Does anybody have any questions or comments about these items? Susan, do you have a presentation on this? Or is that
no, I don't.
Okay.
These are just the standard first quarter personnel actions and additional pay, so nothing out of the ordinary.
Okay. All right. Gary, no. Discussion, I'll entertain a motion to approve FB3.
Thank you.
Thank you, George.
Second.
Thank you, David. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion carries. And with that, I think we'll take a short break. 10 minutes, Julie?
Five minutes.
5 minutes. Be back at 5. I think we're back.
So you know that this
literally is telling me I spent more than my 5 minutes.
I'm giving away
the next item on our agenda. Informational items about the truest bank line of credit. Susan, would you like to discuss that?
Yeah, sure. So not so important for this item, but Jeff, if you could pull up the slide deck, because the next, if you information item. We'll use those slides up for sure. So anyway, I don't want to waste your time, so let me just go over this. A lot of folks were asking me, why do we need a line of credit if our cash position is good, which our cash position is actually, next slide, please. Our cash position is actually very good. We have approximately about 115 days of cash on hand, which, according to Moody's credit rating agency, that's excellent. So, so why did we get one? It's just best practice, plain and simple. It's only a safety net. It's always best that you have one in place before you need one. And this will be an unsecured line of credit, $10 million, with a variable interest rate with a floor of 2.25. Should we need, which I don't anticipate, to use any portion of that, it must be paid off of June 30th of any given year. So, again, this is just best practice, something most institutions have in place in case it's needed, but no, there's no alarm. There's nothing to be worried about. Just to, this was one of the things I had on my checkoff list when I started at WKU. So that's all I have, Jason.
Thank
you. So a question.
Okay.
Is there any cost to us for establishing the line of credit?
No. Only if we use it.
I'd like to say this is a piece of advice I give all of my small business clients to have, even if they don't need it. It's just smart to have it there in case short-term cash flow.
And Susan's right. Susan's always better to have it before you need it. It's always have like a little safety net, and we've done that as well with the company. Don't really need it, but have it, and we got it when we didn't need it. And it was really hard for me to explain to our board members well, it was necessary. It was just a rainy day, you know, just something to have in case.
And when you need it, it's hard to get.
That's right, exactly. Then, yes.
Okay. David?
Just had one comment I wanted to add on that. You know, I had this discussion, and I was thinking, I was looking at the terms of the $10 million, and I was thinking in terms of the full 364 days. I wasn't thinking about the potential for overnight need and transactional need in the in an emergent situation. Susan explained that at great length to me. I totally understand it as a best practice now. And like she said earlier, I was confused because of the cash position of the university and that it was very strong. And just while I've got the floor, thank you, I want to thank Susan and Rebecca Russell and Christy Smith. They spent a lot of time with Koss and I this week. And some of the topics we discussed with them were this line of credit, net position, personnel actions, questions around GASB and the audit, Student Life Foundation, CARES Act reimbursement, spring tuition, retention. All of those items were discussed prior to this meeting so we wouldn't clog a lot of the lines during this session. I appreciate that from all three of them. They gave a lot of time in a very busy week to us.
Thank you, David.
I can second that. I always have appreciated Susan. She's very forthcoming with any information I've asked.
Very good. Any other?
Can I comment on that? That's in the forthcoming nature of Susan is intentional. I've said to every regent, including the representative regents, if you have questions, we want to answer them and help you understand more fully why. And that means that we can have those conversations in advance of the full board meeting because some of them are, to be candid, drilling down into the weeds in a way that is important for individual understanding but not necessarily a worthwhile use of everyone's time. And so that's what good shared governance is about. It's about being transparent and answering those questions and being good partners to make sure that the folks who work with us understand not just the numbers, but the why behind the numbers. Susan and Cheryl and both sides of the organization just do great work there.
Okay, does anybody have any further discussion? Thank you, Susan. And that takes us to our next informational item, the WKU Incident Response Plan.
Yes, so I wouldn't even try to begin to explain all this. So we have our ADP for Information Technology Services, Greg Hackhart, and to go through this exercise, this is something that the board had requested that we do, I guess, Greg, and well over a year ago. So we've completed the exercise, and Greg is here to help lead us through it. I know that he may have some of his staff needed to talk through some questions. So Greg, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. So as Susan mentioned, about a year ago, some of you may remember that Regan Deacon suggested during board discussion that we test our incident response plan as part of our security program. And he talked about the value of outside help with that. So we definitely took that suggestion. And then late last year, we talked to several firms and found that the Crow LLP held a state contract that we could leverage for these services. So as you saw from the earlier presentation, we were a partner in our financial audits for years, and we knew that they had recently acquired a Kentucky-based consulting firm, so we felt that that local presence would be ideal and valuable in the process. Next slide. So what is an IRP, an incident response plan? It's a document that guides our staff and our leadership as we respond to various types of information security incidents. Those are generally threats to data or information. They can include things like the device loss, hacking or system intrusions, threats from insider threats like employee or affiliate data leaks, viruses like malware, ransomware, or even impersonation attempts like social engineering. Our incident response plan at WKU was developed in 2017, and we did that in partnership with Dell SecureWorks. But because of leadership changes at WKU, it was largely filed away. So this exercise was the first external test and review of the plan since its initial development. Next slide, please. So a tabletop exercise, or a TTX, because we like to abbreviate everything in IT. But a TTX is a sort of a dress rehearsal for response plan. So it involves the actual team members at WKU, and they step through the plan using fictitious security incidents as practice. To prepare for our TTX, we sent our plan to Crow along with some additional documentation, including our information security plan, which is available on our website, and our internal disaster recovery plan, so that Crow could put the incident response plan in context. We scheduled most of the day for the exercise. It included a 30-minute overview or introductory presentation about the plan and the process, two one-hour sessions, one for each of the mock incidents, which we call voids, and then a 30-minute wrap-up and review period. The participants that we chose were included, and the team represented the areas of WKU that are referenced in the plan. Next slide, please. Here you'll note that people on the team included people from legal, IT, communications, and then several areas of strategy operations, including HR, internal audit, purchasing, emergency management, and then we even had the EVP herself as a cabinet representative in the process. Next slide, please. We planned the tabletop exercise initially as an in-person exercise, and that's part of the reason why we selected a local firm, but as I mentioned, and it was ultimately conducted in Zoom in late April due to COVID-19. Three professionals from Crow selected two of the ploys that you see here on the screen, including a mock ransomware incident and a mock insider threat or a public disclosure to any data. These ploys were unknown to the team in advance, and they were unveiled gradually as the incidents actually would be in their line. And the team would learn new information from Pro and respond to that real information in real time as the exercise progressed. Following the exercise, Crow put together a document of three major observations and categories of observations regarding our plan and the tabletop exercise itself. Next slide, please. Observation one, or this category, relates to documentation of the plan itself. Crow's points noted that our plan was complete, and that we had the necessary components of incident response plan, but they also suggested several improvements. For example, they noted that we had not updated our plan since 2017, and that mainly referenced or referred to several process guides that were attached to the plan that guide our response to specific incident types, like the ones I mentioned earlier, rather than the plan itself. And then with the next two points you see here, they wanted to make it clear that they felt that the experts in the room were acting more from their experience during the exercise than they were referencing the plan. And they felt that way because there were times when aspects of our approach in the room didn't line up with our documentation or weren't well documented in the plan. So, ironically, I think that even though we were experienced and professionals and whatnot, I think it was more our inexperience in the testing process that caused this, and also the fact that this was our first run through of the plan as a group. Next slide, please. Observation two from Crow, this category relates to roles and responsibilities, which Crow noted that we didn't clearly or explicitly state as we began to utilize that session what the roles and responsibilities of the various team members were. And they also felt that I was acting as the incident security or incident manager role. And then, of course, I didn't clearly state that during the session. I think clearly there were a few things that I think in the group thought were understood during the tabletop exercise that we should definitely clarify in matter of best practice in future exercises. Next slide, please. Observation three related to the completion of essential steps in the plan for critical tasks. Crow noted that we did need to formally decide during the exercise when we were going to declare an incident based on the information that was presented. They also noted that we might consider reverse engineering some of the malicious activity, like in particular the ransomware situation. If we were to reverse engineer the ransomware, it might help us determine its potential impact on our environment and how to better contain it. They noted that we should perform a post-event analysis for each one of the exercises. And then they also gave us a tip from their experience, which is that a single checklist of steps rather than multiple process guides that we had for various types of incidents would help us with our response procedures. Next slide, please. And we agree definitely with all of the observations, and we communicated our response to those to Gavin in June. And we have documented several improvements for future exercises. Those include the fact that we will be explicitly communicating and highlighting team member roles during each one of the bullets in the future. We are going to work off the checklist as suggested. And the checklist will not only contain the steps that we need to complete and check off during the response process, but it will also allow us to assign each one of those tasks to an individual team member, which will help us include more people and have those team members lead that portion of the checklist during the exercise. I think the entire team felt like we didn't have enough time for employee development in the process. So my recommendation is that when we engage in this in the future, that we move to a 90-minute period for broader participation for the employee development. And also, in addition to that 90 minutes, we add another 30 minutes on the end of each employee for post-event analysis. That will essentially move each one of the employee developments from 1 hour to 2 hours, which I think will give us a much better result. I think the entire team felt a little constrained by the time limits previously. And then the last phase that I think we'll cover is that we definitely a formal incident declaration during each employee. The way we're going to track these in the future is that we've got an annually recurring ticket in our service management system, and that will allow us to keep documentation about these suggested improvements for the exercises that we're going to conduct in the future as well as adding in lessons learned for each one of the review periods that we conduct afterward. Next slide, please. We're also making several improvements to the plan itself. For example, I mentioned that we're eliminating compliance process guides and developing response checklists as PRO recommended. The entire team and PRO informally felt that the current plan was rather cumbersome. If you include the process guides, it's about 150 pages, which if you're trying to react in an incident, could be a little bit cumbersome for you. So the new version that's under development, we're eliminating those process guides, replacing those with checklists. That cuts it down by at least half. And then we're also eliminating a lot of wordiness. And PRO pointed out that there were some redundancies of things like data classifications and system criticality between the IRP and the other documentation that we submitted. So they recommended leaving that out of the incident response plan and referring to those other documents, which we'll definitely do. Overall, that shorter length, we hope, just makes the process much more efficient and streamlined. I've also created a SharePoint site that's available to team members. We're going to use that in the future for plan review and recommendations regarding the plan. And then we will also use our service management system to track the plan changes in the future. So we'll be keeping old versions and new versions each time that we update, so that we can see all those changes over time. We're currently finalizing our updates, and we'll be presenting them to the cabinet before the end of the year in preparation for a 2021 exercise. And then in summary, I just wanted to say that I think we learned a lot from this process and this exercise, and I definitely wanted to thank the team for their participation and also thank the regents for their guidance in this process. I definitely look forward to future exercises that should help us improve our plan and our readiness for potential incidents. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg. Is this something that you plan on doing annually from here on out?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Any questions or comments?
Greg, real quick, it's David Brinkley. I'm saying this based on the data that we were provided as regents. Is the reason that WKU is, and again, this is based on what's written here, searching for a different firm to lead the next exercise, is that because you mostly disagreed with the nine observations? It says that you mostly disagreed. I'm going to say partially agree equals mostly disagree with the findings of Crow. Is that why you're looking for a different firm? So you, because you wouldn't have an apples to apples comparison if you switch firms after 1 year. I'm just curious as to what led that decision.
Well, I wouldn't say that I mostly disagree, David. I think basically the reason I said partially agree, and I realize how that sounds, is simply that there were some things that were noted by Crow in the observations that were inaccurate. I pointed out the fact that they said that our plan hadn't been updated since 2017. It's not entirely true, and that's the only reason I said partially agree on that point, because we had some updates that occurred in 2019, but they were generally correct, that the bulk of the plan hadn't been updated since 2017. I don't think that we necessarily want to pick a different vendor in the future, but what I was getting at with that point was that I think we could benefit from a variety or a diverse set of opinions on our plan. I think we've gotten PRO's opinion on our plan, and I think that even though we're undergoing significant changes to it, I think there might be benefit from changing vendors. I'm not totally resigned to that. I definitely would use PRO again. I just felt like, in this case, that we could benefit from that diversity of opinion.
Appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
Thanks.
Jason, I've got a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
Susan, what is our insurance coverage in this area? Are we self-insured on our exposure, or do we have overlines to cover us? If we have an incident, ransomware?
I can answer that. It's helpful. Basically, we do have an insurance policy. Our insurance policy is with Beasley. It's offered to us through Van Meter, and it does cover several incidents like ransomware.
Do you know our coverage limits?
I do. It's generally a $10 million policy. There's other limits that might take it up to 13 in certain circumstances, but generally that's the limit.
Have you had any communications with other universities that have experienced the ransomware and the type of liability exposure they face? Is that enough coverage?
That's the coverage that was recommended to us based on an assessment that Van Meter did when we got the policy. I haven't had conversations with very many universities about their coverage levels. People tend to keep that under cover because of the potential for people to take advantage of that. But I haven't had informal conversations with CIOs at other universities about particular incidents in their environment, and they definitely felt they were well covered by their insurance.
I would suggest to the committee that we ask Greg to come back to the committee with some pricing on additional coverage. Not necessarily recommend that we get more coverage, but if it's not that expensive, we might decide that it's a prudent thing to do. And then I'd ask the committee if, due to the significance of the risk, if somehow the board on a calendar to make sure we get an annual review of the intrusion testing, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, definitely. I think intrusion testing, or penetration testing as we sometimes call it, is a fairly sensitive exercise because it can expose information about your environment that you might not want to publicize. I think the best way to do that would probably be in a closed session or with direct meetings, something like that.
I understand. You could edit our needed privacy and be kept private, or you could just have a report back to the chairman of the finance and budget or to the chair himself. I just think that we need to make sure that this exposure is always addressed.
Yes, definitely. You broke up a little bit in there, but I definitely picked up on what you were saying about the possibility of editing the results and reviewing those.
Greg, your plan was to...
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Freddie. I raised my hand and Jason said I could speak.
Don't finish. Thank you.
Sorry, Freddie. Greg, your plan was to do some kind of drill like this or practice annually, correct?
Yes.
So that you're aware of any potential issues you might have. So the idea is if you would do it annually, then there would be a report. Is that better that we get the report after you do the annual? And I think that may be what Freddie was maybe asking a little bit too.
That for sure. This exercise is a little bit different than what he was just referencing. There's multiple things that we do annually. In this case, like this presentation was regarding a tabletop exercise of the plan, the incident response plan. What Regent Hinkin is also referring to is an annual penetration test of our systems, which is basically like a team of ethical hackers trying to break into our systems. So both of those, we do both of those annually.
All right, thanks, Bob.
Greg, help me remember, when did we first acquire the insurance policy for this kind of liability? I thought I remembered having this conversation with Gordon Johnson when I arrived, but help refresh our memory because this is relatively recent.
Yes.
That's right. It was about 2017, so you definitely would have had that conversation with Gordon.
So we do have liability protection, at least for the past 3 years, we have not had previously.
Dr. Gaboni, I've noticed with our insurance policy company that they're encouraging us to buy. They didn't for a very, very long time. And then this last option we renewed in September, we weren't really given a choice that this was something. So it's, I think something that's become more prevalent that people need to have this kind of security, or at least a policy to protect them.
All right. I think the points we've taken, though, about increasing the rates was once you have the policy in place, sometimes you double the coverage for little additional premium. So that certainly needs to be checked into. I agree.
All right. Anybody else have any discussion or questions? If not, thank you, Greg. And that, Chair Higdon, that concludes the Finance and Budget Committee agenda.
Thank you, Chair McKinney, and the